Hi, it's Gillian here from Irish Funds. Today, we are bringing you the next episode in our series of recordings from the Irish Funds 10th Annual UK Symposium, which took place on November 30th in London. This episode features the panel discussion entitled LTIF 2.0, A New Framework for Long-Term Investments, which was moderated by Aaron Mulcahy of Maples Group and includes Jocelyn Pidou of iCapital Network, David Allen of Stepstone Group, Venkata Kotta of S64 Capital, Gavin Burns of UBS, and James O'Sullivan of the Central Bank of Ireland. With the improved LTIF regime due to go live this month, January 2024, this panel discusses how the Central Bank of Ireland's plans of rolling out the regime in Ireland have been progressing. The panel also considers the appeal of this new product and how to successfully launch and raise assets in an LTIF 2.0 structure. We hope you enjoy this episode and be sure to keep an eye out for further podcasts from the UK Symposium coming soon.
Hi everybody, you're all very welcome to today's first panel discussion today, which is focusing on the new and improved LTIF. You probably haven't missed it, but there is a lot of excitement about this new product. So you got, on one hand, you got the managers, and they're seeing the amazing potential of this to expand their investor base into retail capital. And then on the other hand, you got the investors, and they're seeing it as an opportunity to get exposure to asset classes that up to now they've been largely excluded to. You have policymakers who are hoping that this time around the LTIF is going to be a massive success in terms of getting that capital into the real economy and in particular areas of particular focus such as sustainable investments. LTIF 2.0 is going to allow managers a lot more flexibility in terms of what they can invest in, how concentrated those portfolios are, how much they can borrow, the level of liquidity within the particular portfolio, which is going to allow them to manage redemptions in a better manner. It also allows for funds to disapply certain rules that are applicable to LTIFs in the case of LTIFs that are focused specifically on professional investors. So the hope is this time around it's going to be a massive success, and I suppose that's what our panel here today are going to talk about. We're joined by a great panel of industry experts, and I'm going to give them an opportunity to introduce themselves now in a moment. Just briefly, we got David and Gavin on the manager side, and then we have Jocelyn and Venkata who are going to give a sense of the role that entities who link private managers, private assets, and give that exposure to their clients. And then last but not least, we got James O'Sullivan from Central Bank, who's going to give the all-important view of the Central Bank in terms of the new LTIF and Ireland's steps towards being LTIF ready. My name is Aaron Mulcahy. I'm a partner in a funds and investment management group at Maples in Dublin, and I chair the Irish Funds working group that focuses on the LTIF and Ireland being LTIF ready. So enough from me, I might start over with Jocelyn. Would you mind introducing yourself? And we'll kick it off from there.
Sure, thanks Aaron. I'm Jocelyn Pidou. I'm a managing director with iCapital, focusing on product development and structuring. Quick word about iCapital, we're 10 years old. We have close to 170 billion in platform assets, more than 1,300 funds that we've set up, essentially connecting asset managers with the private wealth channel. So we're part of the movement in terms of including more investors in the private markets asset class.
David Allen, I'm the CEO of Stepstone's AIFM in Dublin, where we have about 100 people. Stepstone work in private markets, private equity, infrastructure, real estate, and private debt. And private debt is the division which is most represented in Dublin. Very happy to be here on the panel. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm Venkata Kotta, Head of Client Solutions at S64. We are a product and solutions innovation company enabled by technology, and we help private banks, wealth managers, deliver private markets content to their investors at speed and scale. Thank you. Great to be here.
Good morning, everyone. James O'Sullivan. So I head up the fund and firm authorization section at the Central Bank of Ireland. So that covers approximately 800 authorizations per year for the product approvals for funds, and between 20 and 30 firm approvals. So they would be administrators, depositories, and management companies, and MiFID trading venues. I also represent the Central Bank on IOSCO's Investment Management Standing Committee.
Gavin Burns, I head up alternative products for UBS Asset Management globally. We manage about 275 billion in alternative assets post the combination with Credit Suisse across strategies such as hedge funds, direct infrastructure, real estate, private credit, and we've got a very large multi-manager business across all those same asset classes as well.
Great. Thanks, everybody. Gavin, I might start with yourself. This trend of the retailization of private assets has really been a standout trend over the course of 2023. Can you say a few words in terms of what you see as driving that interest among non-institutional investors to get exposure to this asset class? And then maybe reflect, is this a trend that's here to stay, or is it something that's just the latest fad?
I don't think it's the latest fad. I think there's some structural drivers around why we're seeing the agenda move in this direction. So first and foremost, there's a regulatory agenda. I don't want to take the wind out of James's sails, but the Capital Markets Union initiative provides a very good tailwind around providing retail investors with different options in terms of how to think about their portfolios going forward and how we think about financing the European economy. So I think it's essential that regulatory agenda moves forward and moves forward at pace if we're going to achieve what we want to achieve from a European point of view. The other structural element to this is, we've seen a very difficult environment over the last 2 years. So many GPs who largely have a concentrated institutional client book are dealing with the denominator effect. So as institutional investors in this market environment are rebalancing their portfolios, obviously they're taking assets out of real assets and private market strategies. We see that at UBS Asset Management for sure. And I think they're looking at different ways in which they can diversify their investor base going forward. So I think the last 2 years, coupled with the regulatory agenda, and frankly, the massive success that we've seen with other GPs raising assets in open-ended, semi-liquid type hybrid structures, I think these elements are coming together to drive the industry towards providing more options for end investors. I think it's a very positive thing, and I don't think it's a fad, and I think it's going to continue into the future.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to take a few audience kind of interaction questions over the course of the presentation, and we might bring up the first one, and you can access it through the app just to kind of give your sense in terms of the question I'm going to ask the audience, I suppose, at this early stage, is to what extent the LTIF is a key priority area for you within your business. So that should pop up shortly, and you'll be able to input your views on that. I'm going to ask the same question of you, David, in terms of from your business, to what extent is the LTIF this kind of focus, given this, move towards retailization and democratization of private assets?
Well, we don't get a vote, but if we did, I'd vote A. It is a strategic priority for us. Absolutely. I mean, I agree with everything Gavin said, from the manager's perspective. If you are in the business of managing private assets for clients, the demand for enabling access for let's call it a private wealth channel, is how we refer to it, to your products. The demand is there, but what really isn't there in some ways are the tools for doing that. There are ways of doing it, and we have done it. For example, Stepstone as a group, we launched US BDC in the US market for US clients to allow access to our private debt in asset class. We have similar products for private equity, venture, and so forth. But in Europe, these are much harder to create. That's why the timing of LTIF is very, very opportune. We have the demand. We have what we believe is an asset class which is very suitable for that distribution channel. And hopefully, with LTIF 2.0, we'll now have the product that we can actually wrap that asset class in to deliver out in a way for those channels that make sense for them and that is an enduring and hopefully relatively simple to understand product that they can take on an evergreen basis, which would be our objective.
Yeah, there certainly is this kind of appetite to replicate that success of the US BDC and the retail style investors kind of buy into that as a product. Venkata, so we have the managers on one side and you have the end investors on the other side, and sitting between them is the distributor. Can you say a few words in terms of what the investors are saying to the distributors, which is then kind of making its way to the managers in terms of key considerations around this as a product and what they need?
Yeah, sure. I mean, content aside, content, of course, investment, content leak, performance, yield, that always is topmost. Potential to diversify their clients' portfolios, so they're looking for that. That's a given. With that given, next is barriers to access, you know, just breaking those down, making it possible easier for their investors to access those products and easier for them to actually distribute the products. And that takes many dimensions. One is, of course, from a regulatory jurisdictional perspective, distributors run a cross-border business, and they need products which sort of, you know, meet those requirements that they have the ability to distribute widely, ideally harmonized, so that it's the same regulation, same investor eligibility everywhere. Secondly, there's also the aspect of things like bite size, minimum investment, client eligibility, so product design having taken into account what are the minimum criteria for investors to be able to come into those. And then it's about investor experience, and investor experience takes multiple facets here. It's actually having products that fit into their existing infrastructure that they're able to support effectively, so being able to plug into their systems, being able to book them, being able to offer them, and to provide reporting, provide transparency, provide information on fees, performance, and being able to do that at scale. And this is exactly what they're looking for. So that's really, it's about facilitating that ecosystem to enable that to happen, and that's really what private banks want. And the way the industry is meeting those needs is in multiple ways. There's regulation, of course, we've talked about that. There's about product design, making products which are suitable for that market, including things like, you know, liquidity, providing some of that. And thirdly, technology. So I think collectively we all recognize that technology is what is going to lead to speed and scale in this market.
Yeah, I think the key message that you're kind of saying there is the scalability of the LTIF. And it's not just a matter of setting up a retail-focused AIF in one jurisdiction for a specific market or a specific group of investors. It's building this cross-border mass product which can then be accessed investors right across the EU in a scalable manner, and then to get the benefit of that.
Correct.
We've had our poll, and it seems to be kind of 30-35% in terms of participants who are seeing it's a key focus, 30% saying it's something you got to look at, and then the rest in terms of not yet a focus. And I think that's probably reflective of what we're seeing. There's some managers who are very focused on it in the first instance and want that kind of first mover advantage, and it fits in nicely with their strategies that they already have or their private assets business. And then you've got the managers who see it as, you know, listen, there's a lot of excitement about this. We need to be thinking about this, but it's more kind of a medium term kind of proposal. So James, we've heard from the managers why they think it's a great idea. We've heard from Venkata in terms of what the investors are saying and how that's kind of articulating through the distributors. What has the central bank been doing in terms of, I suppose, its kind of reaction to facilitating the LTIF, and, you know, what's been happening with the view towards Ireland being LTIF ready when it applies at the start of January or the 10th of January coming?
Yeah, absolutely. So I agree with all the comments made so far. And, I think it was always interesting to hear about the investor demand. Clearly, private assets, huge area of growth in recent years. But yet the capital is generally still being deployed through closed-ended vehicles targeted at professional investors. But there's a public policy reason for the work that's been underway, really linked to the Capital Markets Union agenda, which Gavin mentioned. And there's sustained efforts there. But the LTIF in particular is obviously a key part of that package. And really it's because from a public policy perspective, we need more effective deployment of capital in Europe. We're still too heavily bank reliant in Europe in terms of financing. And even though we've made progress, there's a long way to go. So if you look at venture capital funding, yes, in Europe it's increased a lot since the pandemic, but even in the member states who've made good progress in this area, as a share of GDP, it's still less than half of the United States. So, you know, we were starting obviously from a low base, but there's a lot more to do. And really that's what's driving the public policy response here. Absolutely agree with the comments in terms of the LTIF. Really important that it's a viable product that can have sufficient scale. Speed to market, ease of market around Europe is going to be critical. An awful lot of work has clearly been underway. So if we think about the steps the Central Bank of Ireland has taken, that includes publication of the consultation paper CP155, very important initiative to make sure for the first time you can have an authorised LTIF in Ireland. And what that will mean is the LTIF will be dual authorised under our domestic funds legislation and also authorised under the LTIF regulation. What that means in practice is that it will bring all of the benefits that are afforded to an authorised AIF in Ireland, and obviously the LTIF authorisation will bring with it the passport, which is critical. But alongside that, we're taking very practical steps to make sure we're ready early in the new year to be in a position to authorise LTIFs. So that will include the things you might expect in terms of application forms being published on our website and all of those procedures. For anyone used to engaging with the central bank through our portal, we're also setting up a special return, and really that's to root. So if you're going through an LTIF for professional investors only, you will be authorized based on confirmations, and that'll be subject to a 24-hour turnaround. But if you're targeting retail investors, which we expect a large proportion of LTIFs to do, that will go through a very similar process as we currently have for UCITS. Alongside that, we're doing a lot of industry engagement, so we have a workshop scheduled for December, and I think the purpose of that is twofold. One, it's to understand what industry expect to see in terms of particular LTIFs, and I do think, just given the scope of LTIF 2.0, each LTIF is likely to be different with different sets of portfolio composition, investment strategy, objective, and coupled with that and complementary to that, different liquidity provisions, etc. So what we will also want to do at that workshop with industry is really set out our expectations, what are the areas we plan on looking at in detail during our review process for retail-focused LTIFs. But for anyone used to engaging with the central bank on other products, there won't be any surprises there. So really, unlike a professional product, we will be looking at retail investor understanding of the disclosures. We'll be making sure that it makes sense from a liquidity management perspective in terms of the assets that are being targeted. But I do think it's a hugely positive initiative, and I think changes in an Irish context, like, for example, the LTIF being able to originate loans, is really significant. And I hope it unlocks the capital flows we need from a public policy perspective to make Europe more effective and more efficient going into the future.
Yeah, no, that's great. I think the publication of the consultation just marks that clear intention for Ireland to be LTIF ready at the start of January. And the few points you raise in terms of the professional-only LTIF and that 24-hour authorization process, I think that could be attractive to managers who are really looking for that speed to market in terms of the LTIF. So rather than going through that detailed kind of review, which is retail-focused, there is that kind of fast-track approach. And something I think you didn't mention, and you might want to pick it up, is just around the kind of the central bank's transparency around kind of delivery timeframes for you know, where people go through that retail focused approach and you're interacting with the central bank, that there's that clarity in terms of kind of timeframes for delivering responses, which again from a manager's perspective is fundamental, because you want to know, you know, how long is it going to take us to get this product going. You know, you want as much certainty as possible. And I suppose lastly, being able to use the kind of flagship fund structures like the ICAV and the ILP with the LTIF product is fundamentally important. So it benefits from all of the kind of the benefits we're all used to in the context of authorized funds, whether it's efficient tax treatment or otherwise. So all really, really positive. I might just switch kind of gear now in terms of and move over to you, Jocelyn. You set up your LTIF. It's not just a matter of setting up the LTIF. You have to then enable it just to make sure that that is the greatest success possible. So I think the audience in the room would probably like to hear from you in terms of, you know, what does that involve? What does that mean? You know, how do you make it as great a success as possible from that perspective over the life cycle?
Sure, thanks. I think we're quite uniquely positioned in the market because first, we are speaking to a very large, broad swath of both GPs and asset managers and distributors and wealth managers. So we are hearing from both sides, you know, what will it take to make one of these vehicles, such as the new LTIF 2.0, a success in the market. We also have the experience of having, you know, managed quite, you know, several billions of open-ended semi-liquid product in the format of, you know, non-traded REITs and BDCs out of the U.S. Certainly one of the most, I think, important features of the new LTIF 2.0 is the fact of the liquidity and the fact that they will, you know, have the ability to be presented in a semi-liquid or open-ended type evergreen format. And I think if I were a GP or an asset manager, and it looks like two-thirds of the audience at least are interested in this topic, I would be thinking about, I think, three major themes. So the first being the life cycle of one of these products. So again, very used to bringing professional investors closed-ended drawdown style product, and then how do you construct a portfolio that has the liquidity, the composition in order to meet the requirements of both the regulation and to offer this into a market to distributors and to individual investors. So I like to make the bit of a light comparison, but you know, everybody's sort of focused on the wedding day and you know, what do you do to plan for that day one, the launch? But what they don't think about is then the evergreen nature of the product and the actual marriage, and that it's going to be going on for cycles and cycles, and how do you manage these products through the twists and turns of an economic cycle? So the second piece is technology, certainly. So our technology platform has been built to be able to handle and support all of the various stakeholders in the industry on managing one of these semi-liquid evergreen type products for individual investors. So thinking about things like monthly subscriptions, maybe, you know, we'll see when the RTS comes out, but quarterly redemptions, you know, gates, soft lockups. So how do we handle the life cycle of one of these products? And technology is certainly a way to bring the scale and efficiency to these products that others have mentioned earlier. And then the last point, which can't be underestimated, I think, is the ability to bring along with these products education and the right, you know, everyone in every stakeholder taking responsibility toward the end investor in one of these products, because, you know, certainly we can make assumptions about, you know, who the investor type will be. And when GPs and asset managers are constructing these products, hopefully they have in mind that end target investor, because at the end of the day, it's going to be very important in terms of the reporting, the onboarding experience, and the type of information that's disseminated to these investors through distributors, through wealth managers, and all of the intermediaries in the cycle. So I would be, you know, thinking about these major topics if I were a GP or an asset manager today.
I might come in there if I can. I mean, they're really good points. I agree with all of them. I mean, just to remark on the very first one about how GPs have to work differently, it is fundamentally different when you're managing a subscription-based product than a capital calling product. I mean, managers in private markets have become very, very smart at calling capital at precisely the right time, using subscription lines and so forth to effectively give themselves the best chance of delivering IRR returns to their investors. You can't do that with a subscription-based product. The money comes every month. You've got to be able to use it. You've got to be able to put it to work. And that needs a lot of planning for managers who are accustomed to dealing with only receiving the money at precisely the moment that they're choosing. Now they have to be able to work on a basis of saying, well, we've got to be prepared for the money to come in, to put to work, in order to build a portfolio with the right risk characteristics and so forth, so that we can support whatever it is in terms of periodic liquidity or the fund characteristics. So that's a very, very big mind shift for the GPs after the wedding day.
Maybe just to comment on that, because I absolutely agree and I enjoy the wedding analogy, but I do think if you haven't got the wedding right, it's unlikely the marriage will go right. and I think from our perspective, again, with all products, the design phase is really important. And what I'd encourage managers to do who are in this space, and I thought the results were interesting, and I think reflect the fact that actually this won't be for all managers. And initially, I think it will be for managers who are already operating in this space and want to make the shift to that retail segment, which we've been talking about. But over time, it's likely to pick up, and I think more managers will move in that space. But my message would be come and engage early. So if you're thinking of launching one of these products, come and have discussions with us, if it's in Ireland or other regulators, to talk about actually what you're planning, your structuring, because I think that's really important. And having that dialogue at the design phase should hopefully mean throughout the life cycle of the product, it'll be a success.
And I think from a manager's perspective, like the idea of being able to come in and talk to the central bank about their product is very important. You know, it's everybody wants this to be kind of a nice, smooth process, and having those early dialogues just helps kind of focus in on the key issues at an early stage of the process.
Just one point on that, Aaron. So, are
you the dodgy mic? Yeah.
Gone here, so I'm going to have to raise my booming voice, and I'll avoid the wedding analogy in case Mrs. Burns is here today. But in that regard, just taking a step back, really and truly, you've got to look at what you're trying to achieve from a strategy perspective as it relates to the private wealth channels. So when we talk about the retailization or democratization of private markets, we're not talking about going to Mama and Papa Burns, right? I think that's a very, very important distinction to highlight. We're talking about the mass affluent, high net worth individuals that in the main are advised. So, you know, the getting to those types of clients today is a challenge. We've mentioned scalability, and that's the critical point here. There are structures out there today that one can leverage, but there are limitations, right? So whilst you can have a strategy around that, doing it to scale is difficult. What the ELTIF provides is a scalable way of doing that. So S64 and iCapital have done a remarkable job helping GPs with their institutional product, enabling that with all of the different distribution channels in the private wealth space within Europe and Asia. So that will need to continue on, because there will be certain types of clients that don't want to deal with the inefficiency within a fully funded type of structure like an ELTIF. There will be a dilution of returns associated with that. And ultimately that will continue on, right? So you will have clients of a certain size with wealth managers of a certain size that can still enable and provide for that. I think what the ELTIF really does provide is a way of doing that at scale. So, you know, you've got two cohorts of managers out there. You've got traditional asset managers that are used to setting UCITS at scale with many, many distribution partners around Europe and APAC. And then you've got bulge bracket GP firms that have largely just sold to institutional investors, you know, over the last 10, 15, 20 years. Now, the traditional managers are going to have an edge there. They will have the infrastructure, they will have the piping, they will have the plumbing, and if they can get the product strategy right around ELTIFs, they can actually steal a march on some of the GPs that do not have all of that piping and plumbing. And let me emphasize, it is a big endeavor to put all of that in place, I can assure you. To Jocelyn's point, it's very, very complicated. So, you know, my expectation will be that the ELTIF is going to be front and center around how we scale access into those channels going forward. And it'll be an interesting dynamic to see how traditional asset managers that are all very eager to build alternative businesses, how they leverage the ELTIF to do that, versus how your more bulge bracket GPs will endeavor to do that now going forward.
Absolutely. We might ask the next question to our audience, and it kind of picks up on some of the discussions we've just touched upon, is what do you see to be the main challenges raising retail products? And we're talking about distribution. Is it liquidity? Is it this enabling of the ELTIF, which is touched upon now, or is it something we haven't necessarily thought about? I'm going to pick up now in terms of this kind of semi-liquid style ELTIF, and a lot of the focus has been on this particular type of product. There is talk about the regulatory technical standards being subject to some element of delay, and for those of you who are less familiar with it, there's a couple of bits within the RTS which are fundamentally important to structuring these products from an open-ended liquidity perspective. So you have kind of open questions on to what extent you can offer redemptions, or the frequency of those redemptions, you know, any minimum holding periods, minimum notice periods. So they feed into kind of some fundamental decisions in terms of how you structure a product. Might even just go to David and Gavin. You know, what does this kind of potential for a delay around the RTS mean in terms of products in the pipeline? And does it to some degree, you know, is there a little bit of damage there potentially to the ELTIF product?
Well, I think it depends on what we get. I mean, the delay won't be damaging if we get answers that the industry can work with. To a certain extent, the clue here is in the name of the panel. It's ELTIF 2.0, because we did have ELTIF 1.0, and it didn't really have a meaningful impact on asset management within Europe, because there were flaws with how the product was constructed. 2.0, we got the opportunity to reset and fix those things. In my opinion, offering the opportunity for predictable liquidity measures is very, very important for this. It's a key feature that I think the end investor, which will be, as Gavin said, mass affluent, generally advised, but most people, even in that channel, want to understand when or how they might be able to realize their asset at a future date if they need to, because their circumstances of life have required them to. It's a key part, and managers looking at this will see that if they're, GPs anyway, if you're in private markets today, you're working on closed-ended products, you're working on making capital calls to institutional investors generally. If you're moving to a subscription-based product, it's a completely different market type, product type. Your end audience, I think, will need to have viable, meaningful ways of being able to get liquidity that is easy to understand, and as much as possible, provides relative certainty for them.
Gavin, in your view?
Regulatory innovation is a iterative process. So we see that in terms of where we are on UCITS 5 today. So we've looked at LTIF 1, I don't know how many times, and just have come to the determination that we just can't make it work for us, and we can't offer end clients a good outcome and a strong value proposition. LTIF 2.0 is a massive step in the right direction for UBS. We have plans to launch two LTIFs in Q1 of next year, and they will be our first LTIFs that we do launch as a firm. We wait with bated breath on the RTS in terms of some clarity, particularly around the liquidity provisions that we need to think about in terms of product design. But irrespective as to what way that RTS falls, I think we're very much of the view LTIFs are going to be very much part of the different tool set that we have that will enable us to target the private wealth channels. So I think for us, it's critically important. The LTIF will go through different iterations as we move forward, but I think we're of the view this is a space that we absolutely have to be in. If we're serious about targeting the private wealth channel. So I think, critically important for us.
James, I'll let you in.
Yeah, so absolutely agree with that. I am constrained in what I can say because it is a live issue, but let me offer a personal perspective. So firstly, regulators are very keen to get this done and to ensure there is no delay. And what it's about is trying to strike that right balance between having the appropriate safeguards, but ultimately having a product that works. And I'll link it back to the comments I made earlier about the public policy agenda here. We are absolutely not in the space of wanting to create a product like LTIF1 that actually isn't viable. And it is that balance between how much flexibility you leave at the manager level to decide and then what becomes more prescriptive in the RTS. The RTS is clearly hugely significant in terms of notice period, redemption frequency, liquidity management tools, all of those core provisions. But what I would say is that the thinking can be progressing, and the Commission's been very clear on that. The work in the background can be going on in terms of getting those LTIFs ready to launch, pending working out the final details in terms of the RTS. And what I would also say is that I think that dialogue I mentioned earlier with the regulators might become increasingly important, particularly if there's elements of the RTS that are subject to some national discretions or engagement with the NCAs. So obviously some issues will be prescriptive, but some may be subject to engagement with the NCAs. And that's why I would certainly encourage that early engagement I spoke about.
Yeah, and I think that's a key point. And I mean, it's not unique to the Irish funds industry in terms of, wanting it to have the greatest possibility for success. And then given the fact that you have such a broad range of assets now you can invest in, there is no one size fits all in terms of that. So it's important to have guardrails in place, but also having that flexibility to talk about that. So if a manager wants to be able to offer something, for example, more than quarterly redemptions, that they can present the case that it's consistent to portfolio, the stress testing, et cetera, and have that dialogue on a case-by-case basis. So having that flexibility, from my perspective, is one of the fundamental pieces that we're hoping to see shine through in terms of the finalized RTS. Venkata, so there is this lots and lots of focus on these semi-liquid open-ended style LTIFs. Does that mean that we're going to see way more of these than your closed-ended style funds? Or, you know, what are the distributors and investors kind of saying? You know, do they have, you know, is it just a matter that this is kind of the new element that the LTIF offers, and it's going to largely overtake the kind of closed-ended structures? Or what's the market kind of showing at this early stage in the process?
There's a lot of excitement at the moment about semi-liquids. I mean, what's there not to like about the product, which offers liquidity and, you know, can be accessed with a low minimum investment by mass affluent, as we've always been talking about. There is, I'd say, a lot of cautious optimism from the managers on how this is going to pan out. I think, again, a lot of it depends on what shape the RTS takes. I don't think that is to say that there isn't a place for closed-ended LTIFs. LTIF as a format and the revamped LTIF 2.0 does offer a lot of enhancements which do make that format more attractive with or without liquidity. You know, we've talked about scale, the ability to offer more widely, to have that harmonized ability, you know, across the EEA to be able to make that product available with low minimum investments. So there are features that make it attractive. So there will always be a space for LTIFs, even if they are closed-ended. So it's not to say that, I think it's too early to say that open-ended LTIFs are going to be the majority of the space. So I would say in terms of format, it's there, it's here to stay, as we've all said. The liquidity is an attractive feature. There is a very strong interest from investors, distributors to offer it, but it's a question of let's watch this space. Let's see what that liquidity looks like. So that is going to be important.
Just one point on that, Aaron. I mean, if you look at the US space, you still have closed-ended funds. You still have those funds being enabled to the equivalent private wealth type affluent investor over in the US. But you also have, you know, BDCs, you've got interval funds. There's just a different tool set in the US that we're doing a bit of a catch-up on here from a European perspective. So I don't, you know, one may become more dominant over the other from a European point of view, but I think if you're an asset manager that's serious about targeting private wealth, you're going to be using all of these different tools.
Yeah. We've got some questions coming in from the audience, and I might just ask one of Jocelyn, if I might. And it is, excuse my squinting here, given the retail focus of the LTIF, what distribution channels, banks, platforms, etc., do you believe will be best for this type of a product? Is there any kind of clarity on that at this stage?
Yeah, so I think we're seeing kind of, I'm going to say, traditional private banks, you know, large wealth institutions, you know, taking a very constructive view toward retail products and towards the new LTIF, especially because within the banks themselves, you know, there is very extensive eligibility and appropriateness tests that needs to be done on each investor, and the LTIF, you know, will open up a new set of, let's say, more retail type or mass affluent investors into this type of asset class. I mean, the other point that I think is very interesting in terms of innovation and what this new, I'm going to call the LTIF 2.0 a product enabler, because with the enablement of these types of structures and new regulation, the industry is also innovating, and we do see you know, platforms such as ourselves, so iCapital, where we've launched a global marketplace where we have a product shelf of funds that we have set up with various GPs and asset managers that is fully accessible in a digitized experience for wealth managers and distributors to come on, see, you know, all the different products and the offering that is on, and we're not the only platform that has done that. So I think, you know, we will see and continue to see sort of the more traditional style interest and investment from the wealth channel through the various institutional means, as well as innovation from different market participants.
Yeah. It's probably one we didn't discuss ourselves previously to any extent as a panel in preparing for this, and it's ESG. And I mean, given the fact that you know, this retail focus here, and retail investors in the UCITS space have very much shown themselves as having this bias towards funds that are categorized as Article 8 or 9. What's the, I might even start Venkata at the first stage, what are we getting a sense in terms of what type of classifications is going to materialize? Because I mean, suppose you have your retail investors, they have to get some sort of advice. As part of that advice, they're giving an indication of their sustainability preferences, and that certainly kind of drives investors to a certain outcome, primarily 8 or 9 funds. Yeah. So, and while we're still talking about kind of mass affluent or high net worth individuals, they still are going to have to undertake that kind of sustainability preference indication. So is the expectation consistent with the UCITS trend to see more of these kind of retail-focused LTIFs being categorized 8 and 9, or even different shades of 8, per se?
Yes, I think that's a resounding yes. Definitely 8, I mean, 6 is difficult in terms of distribution base. There is, of course, a segment, non-European Asian investors, for example, for banks and distributors who do have Asian booking centers, you know, it doesn't make a huge difference for that. But certainly in Europe, I'd say green, dark green, 9, that's kind of where it's heading. So there is a preference from the distributors to have that label on.
It's pretty hard to deliver for the GPs and managers, though. I mean, again, when it's private assets, typically the companies involved can be, a lot of them can be non-European. A lot of them are private. They are private companies. Some small or medium-sized, and just actually getting data can be very challenging.
And I think things hopefully are improving as there's some element of efforts to standardize reporting as we're going through the process, which will enable managers to have better information in terms of the loans or otherwise that they're investing in. James, I bring you in there.
So absolutely agree, it's still a challenge from a data perspective, but I do think positively it's improving, and we've seen that in terms of the disclosures are consistently getting better over time. And it was only at the start of this year the SFDR level 2 requirements, the template disclosures came in, so it's relatively short, and it's positive to see improvements. If you think about the Irish market at the moment, there's still a majority of funds that are Article 6, but when you look at what we're authorizing this year, more than half of them, the more over 50% are either Article 9 or Article 8. I think in Article 8 you clearly have a spectrum of different products, but we are also seeing consistently very good Article 8 products that are sustainable, that have very good disclosures. And I suspect, and let's see what happens in terms of LTIFs, but I suspect there'll be more in that space, and time will tell.
But that trend, just in that point, I mean, I wouldn't conflate ESG with the LTIF label. I mean, if you're an asset manager that wants to drive sustainable investing, is that the heart of what you want to offer clients, whether it's a QAIF or a UCITS or an LTIF, you know, you're going to drive that agenda through those structures regardless, right? So I don't think it's an exclusive type of consideration as it relates to LTIFs.
No, I completely agree. I think that's one of the reasons the Commission are looking at a more detailed labelling regime, because I think part of the challenge is investors are using Article 8, Article 9 classifications, but without sufficient nuance. And you do need actually a more detailed framework with more nuance, but that will take some time to come.
Great. Okay. Outside the LTIF, are we seeing kind of broader trends towards use of other kind of retail structures? And I think you kind of touched upon this a little bit earlier, Gavin, in terms of they're there, but there's a bit of heavy lifting. But, I suppose, in Ireland, we have the retail investor AIF, which is kind of the sister of the more popular qualifying investor AIF. And it's something that we're considering as an industry to what extent something like that might be popular, because we're certainly seeing kind of corresponding use of the Luxembourg Part 2 funds.
Yeah, I mean, we have Part 2 funds that we sell to private wealth already, and at, you know, significant scale. So I think that's just been a structure, it's been around for a long time, that managers have utilized. You've got other options around retail quays, to your point, Aaron. I think really though, if you to my point earlier, if you want to do things at scale, you've got to leverage the LTIF, right? Because there's just so many efficiencies around how LTIF 2.0 looks like that you know it's got to be front and center as to what you do. There is always going to be other tools that you're going to have to use for different cohorts of investors, etc. And I think one topic that we don't need to delve into the black box of it today, but digitization and tokenization. I mean, these enablers are going to make the process of accessing commitment drawdown structures, you know, with a value proposition that equates to what institutional investors can access, amenable for private wealth over the medium to long term. Okay, so the reality is, whilst the LTIF can get you to scale fast, the other products or the other methods of accessing private markets and real assets will be enabled through digitization, and that will come up the curve very, very fast as well. But as I said, LTIF is certainly going to be the core if you're serious about raising capital in Europe for private market and real asset strategies. But there are other tools that you're going to have to use as well for different types of investor segments.
Gavin, if I could add to that as well, I think you know you can't ignore. We're talking here about Europe, and you know that is a huge focus. But the flows coming in from non-European booking centers, whether it be the wealth centers in Switzerland or you know UK, Singapore, Hong Kong, even in APAC. And so I think the LTIF also presents a great opportunity, and you know there are regulators here, for example, I mean, to go and speak to these third-party countries as well. Ireland has had great success in you know bringing UCITS and is a very strong market presence for its domestic vehicles. So, you know, going out and saying we have this LTIF product and, you know, it, to offer it to retail investors, to third-party countries as well, be it Singapore, Switzerland, and, you know, really make the bridge also to those outside of the EU.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, you know, in reflecting on this, preparing for this panel, I mean, I've been thinking, how do we know if LTIF has been a success? I mean, we will know when we're in those conversations with wealth management channels, with clients and so forth, and the question comes up, what kind of a product is it? It's an LTIF, and they go, tick, great, I know what that is, let's move on. If we can get to that point, it works. We still need all the tactical solutions that Gavin mentioned for specific reasons, which we have today, but if we can get to that market acceptance for LTIF for this channel, that's going to be success.
And we've seen an element of, in Italy, for example, where the LTIF has really taken off, kind of started off in the first instance as, you know, there's some tax benefits associated with this LTIF product. But as time has gone on, it created a name in its own right. And that then kind of created that momentum. It's not, I want an LTIF because it's more, I want an LTIF. So I think that's going to be something that develops over time. I completely agree. We'll let it get a name as you said. You know, we'll be talking about, you know, will everybody in this room kind of be talking about LTIFs more next year? Time for one other question. It's a quick one because we have a broad range of participants in the audience, kind of from various different, you know, managers, service providers, and otherwise. So what we say here is there's a lot of coverage on managers and how the LTIF will be managed, but what are the thoughts and areas for consideration for the providers working to support these vehicles? So let's narrow that down a little bit more, like, you know, say, from an administrator's perspective, you know, you've got asset classes which are, you know, private assets, but then you have the possibility of lots of investors. So I can see you nodding there, Gavin. Yeah, you nodded, yeah. Nodded too enthusiastically.
So the service providers that are very strong at servicing UCITS funds and facilitating mass market around Europe and APAC tend to be the traditional service providers. Those that have a very, very strong alternatives offering as well are going to be very well positioned to be able to support asset managers as they drive that strategy forward, because the nuance of alternative strategies being made available to a retail type or MiFID non-professional investor base, that's going to be a dynamic that we've not dealt with before. So I think that's going to raise some challenges for alternative-only providers and traditional-only providers. Those that can do both are going to be very well positioned to capitalize on that.
Yeah, with my Irish green jersey on, you know, there's a lot of already expertise in the private asset space, and then kind of merging that with the expertise in terms of the mass retail distribution is probably one of the sweet spots. Conscious I'm getting a time up note, can I ask everybody to give a round of applause to our excellent panel in terms of... Thank you. Thanks, everybody.